ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
Srimad-Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 7, Text 12, Commentary by His Divine Grace, Srila Insan Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. I'll just read, let me see. Well, yeah. I'm getting past 40. Once you get past 40, your eyes tend to get a little weak. Okay, I'll just read this out. Many thanks to the devotee who very neatly wrote this on the board, but I'll just read it as it is, because you can't chant this in a meter. Actually, it's nothing to do with being past 40, it's just too small. Even someone who's 10 years old could hardly read this. Putting it on your... Itam avarita purusha paricharyaya bhagavati pravardhamana nuraga bharadruta hridaya shaitilya prahasa veginatman yubhidyamana Roma Pulaka Kulaka Od Kantya Pravrita Pranaya Bhashpa Nirudhavaloka Nayana Ivam Nijaramana Runa Charana Ravindhanu Dhyana Parichita Bhakti Yogena Parichuta Paramaladha Gambhira Hridaya Hrada Vadadha Dishanasthanapi Kriyamanam Bhagavat Saparyam Nasasmara. Translation. Oh, you didn't read the purport? Sorry. Okay. The eight bodily transformations are technically called Ashta Sattvic Vikara. These are manifest in the person of, in the body of someone who has attained to the stage of Bhav, or the preliminary stage of love of God. Some of the symptoms are mentioned here. Others are described in such books as Chaitanya Charitamrita, Nectar and Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, such symptoms as Romancha, hair standing on end, Gadgada Vacha, means faltering voice, then Vaivarnya, the whole body loses its color and becomes pale, Stabda, one becomes stunned, Unmatta, one becomes like a crazy man, Unmatta. So all these are symptoms of someone who's very advanced in devotional service. These symptoms are not to be imitated. It's not that if you imitate falling on the ground or crying, that love of God will come. It has to come around the other way. You get the point that first you get love of God and then you get the symptoms. Don't think, I'll show the symptoms and then I'll get love of God. It doesn't work like that. Sometimes some people, they buy a very prestigious car model, like Cadillac, something like this, but it's very old. They get it cheap. And then they decorate it and paint it so it looks like new. And they wear an imitation Rolex watch, which looks the same, but it only costs $20. And in this way, they drive around in their Cadillac with their imitation Rolex watch, and they dress up as if they're very rich. And the story is there, that joke is there, that, well, why do you always keep your Cadillac in your garage? Why don't you bring it out? I don't have any money to put the diesel in, the gas in. So someone may show the symptoms of being rich, but they're only imitative symptoms. If someone thinks, oh, you see, this rich man is driving a Cadillac car, so I should also get a Cadillac car and I'll also become rich. It doesn't work like that. There's another thing. Sometimes a group of people get together and jointly buy a Cadillac. That also not new. And they take it in turns. One day a week, one person will drive it. Another day, someone else will drive it. So it's all show. They don't actually have the qualification of being a rich person. So imitation won't help us. In fact, imitation is counterproductive to advancement in devotional service. The first two symptoms of a surrendered devotee are anukalyasya sankalpa, pratikulyasya varjanam. He accepts everything favorable for advancement in devotional service and rejects everything unfavorable. Imitation of the symptoms of an advanced devotee are in the category of pratiku. They actually work against our advancement. They don't help us to advance. And therefore, great devotees who are on that platform, they often don't show, they deliberately suppress such symptoms. And Acharya may be on the platform of love of God. But because he's an Acharya means one who teaches by example, he has to show how to behave for the sadhaks or aspiring devotees. So internally, he may be feeling so many symptoms of love of God, but externally, he doesn't fall on the ground and so many different things. Sometimes he may be overcome by emotions and not be able to control it. But generally, he doesn't make a show. Once in Mayapur at the festival with so many devotees present, Prabhupada sitting on the Vyasasan became stunned in ecstasy. And he just became silent and stopped speaking. And all the devotees, they didn't know what to do. What should we do? We don't read in the Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam or the Nectar of Devotion what you should do if your spiritual master becomes stunned in ecstasy. So after a few minutes, one of the devotees started leading a kirtan. And then Prabhupada, hearing that, gradually came out of his ecstatic trance. He said, yes, just chant Hare Krishna. So later there was a controversy among the devotees. Some were saying that, yes, that was nice, you led the kirtan like that. And others said that, no, you shouldn't have disturbed Prabhupada in his ecstasy. So later, some of the devotees asked Prabhupada that, Prabhupada, what should devotees do if the spiritual master goes into an ecstatic trance? And Prabhupada replied, as if embarrassed, well, I don't often do that, as if to excuse himself, that, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't really mean to do that. Another time, a devotee commented about one of the photos of Prabhupada that maybe you've seen. There's quite a well-known picture of Prabhupada looking very grave with the corners of his mouth actually turned down. So one devotee remarked to Prabhupada that, Prabhupada, in this photo, you look very sad. He suggests you take the hand away from your mouth because it doesn't look this. So Prabhupada said, you don't know. This is transcendental ecstasy. So what is actually ecstasy? That is seen by one's constant endeavor to serve Krishna, not by any external show. Privately, a devotee may experience so many things. An Acharya who's preaching all over the world, he doesn't have any private life anyway. There's no inside and outside, it's both the same. It's not that he's speaking so many things, but then he goes away and locks himself in his room and smokes a cigarette. Any time of the day or night, if you see Prabhupada, or you see any devotee who's actually advancing on the path of Krishna consciousness, they're always doing something in Krishna's service. Even eating, sleeping, bathing, they just do these things for the sake of maintaining the body for Krishna's service. So this is advancement in Krishna consciousness. Even we read about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, his amazing transformations of bodily ecstasy. Even one time, all the limbs of his body, his head, his legs, his arms, entered within his body in ecstasy. No one can imagine. Just like it's described, there are 8 symptoms of ecstasy which are described in Shastra, but this one is not described. Not described in Shastra or not conceived of. Even Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he first met Ramananda Rai on the banks of the Godavari, he was experiencing symptoms of transcendental ecstasy. Fainting, falling on the ground. But then he noticed there were many brahmanas present. They were brahmanas, very pious, exalted people, no doubt. They weren't devotees, so they couldn't understand these symptoms. Therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, on seeing them, suppressed his symptoms of ecstasy. With great difficulty, he suppressed his ecstasy and behaved like a normal sannyasi. So these are the examples we receive from our acharyas. Anukaran and Anusharan, there are 2 words. Anukaran means to imitate, and Anusharan means to take shelter or to follow in the footsteps. There's a difference. Anusharan means to follow the example of always being engaged in Krishna's service, giving up material desires. This is Anusharan. Anukaran, or imitation, means to falsely exhibit the symptoms of advancement when we don't have it within our heart, so that others will think that we are great devotees and praise us. So the example is being given here of Bharat Maharaj, who was actually a very exalted devotee. And the symptoms of his advancement are being given in some detail so as to make a contrast between his later condition. As we will read in future chapters, he will fall down from that position due to attachment to an insignificant baby deer. How did that happen? Here in this verse, it's described that Bharat Maharaj, he became so much absorbed in ecstasy that he didn't even follow the regulated principles of devotional service. That may happen on the platform of high ecstasy. For instance, if you're so much in ecstasy that you don't know whether it's day or night, you're going to have difficulty performing your early morning rituals. Or if you're so much absorbed in ecstasy of love of God, then you may just completely forget that you're supposed to take a bath in the morning. You see what an exalted stage this is? It's certainly not, it's not something to be imitated. It's very, very high level. But we see that Bharat Maharaj, even though he was on such a high platform, eventually, at some point, he allowed Maya to enter his heart. Now, what happened, we'll read later on, is that a young baby deer was left all alone. What happened? One deer who was pregnant, fully pregnant, came down to the river to drink water. At that time, a lion very close by roared loudly, and in great fear, the deer jumped over the river. But as she jumped, the baby deer came out of her womb. And just after that, the deer, the mother deer, out of the experience of fear and exhaustion of giving birth, fell down dead. So Bharat Maharaj saw this, and he became compassionate upon the baby deer. That is the trick of Maya. Babies of any species, they're sweet. They are fully in need of protection. So that tendency that we have to think, I am the controller, I am the maintainer, I am the benefactor, that becomes evoked by the sight of babies. Therefore, advanced transcendentalists, they remain aloof from family life. For this reason, Bharat Maharaj had left his home. He was previously a grihastha. Because in family life, the illusion of thinking that I am the controller of this family, I am the maintainer of this family, I am the best friend of these family members is very, very strong. Now, this doesn't mean that those who are in family life should just immediately abandon that. That is also not recommended. One has to gradually cultivate detachment by the proper process. And it's also not that devotees are callous to material suffering. Callous, it means indifferent to. Callous means indifferent to because having no feelings. Rather, a devotee feels for the suffering of others more than others. When we say, well, opening hospitals is useless. Good example, that one, you'll find that in Science of Self-Realization, there was so much famine and suffering in Andhra Pradesh, one part of India. And the head of the relief fund asked Prabhupada that your society has a lot of money and manpower. Why don't you help us to help these poor, suffering people? Prabhupada wrote back refusing. Was it because of drought, was it? I think it was because of drought. Was it drought or flood? It's either there's drought or there's flood. It's one of the two things. That time, there's more droughts than floods in Andhra. It was because of drought, I believe. Drought means lack of rain for many months. The Prabhupada refused to help. He said, this is all useless. He said, you give all your men and money to help us. Prabhupada, he said that the reason people are suffering like this is because they are averse to Krishna. And as long as the people of the world are averse to Krishna, there must be floods, droughts, famines, and so on. So it would appear that Prabhupada is being very hard-hearted. But no, actually, the devotee is most concerned about others suffering, preaches Krishna consciousness, which is the only permanent solution to suffering. You cannot stop suffering in this material world. That's why Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that the neophyte devotee ringing the bell in the temple is doing far more valuable welfare work for the world than anyone who opens millions of hospitals. Because that ringing the bell in the temple gives transcendental benefit to the world. Whereas opening hospitals, that can only benefit the body. Ultimately, you can't even benefit that either, because you have to die anyway. So actually, if you give people medical treatment, but you don't teach them how to be Krishna conscious, it's better you let them die. Because if they become healthy without spiritual knowledge, they'll commit more sinful activities and make worse karma for future. Now, having said all this, a devotee is not indifferent to the immediate physical and mental sufferings of others. Just to give a small example, Prabhupada once called his servant into his room. Would these people like to come and sit down? They just came in. You like to sit? If you want, you can come inside. They can come and sit on the bench if they're not used to sitting on the floor. So Prabhupada once called a servant into his room, and Prabhupada said, you see this bug on the table? Bug, a little insect. So generally if people see a bug, they go, whoop. Prabhupada said, I've been observing this bug for the last 20 minutes. It hasn't moved. I think it must be hungry. Take it out and put it on a leaf and make sure it gets something to eat. So it may be that living beings we come in contact with, the devotee may do something to try to alleviate their immediate condition. And sit here. Sit here on the bench. So Bharat Maharaj, seeing the condition of the baby deer, felt some compassion and therefore did something to try and help. Now, he should have been very careful at this point, because with a baby of any species, once you start taking care, it's an ongoing thing. With a hungry bug, you can put him on a leaf and forget about him. But a baby is totally dependent for many years. That's why many people in the modern age, they don't like to have children. They consider they're a nuisance. They're a nuisance, a disturbance. If I have a baby, then I can't have a job or a career, and I can't go to parties. And those natural motherly feelings are not present in people, in women who want to simply enjoy sense gratification. So Bharat Maharaj should have been very careful at this point in thinking what to do. He shouldn't have risked his whole spiritual life for the sake of a baby deer. He should have considered, just like Prahlad Maharaj described, that even a very loving mother and father cannot actually protect a child. Nor can medicine actually help a person who's sick. Nor can a boat save a drowning man, unless Krishna desires. Rakhe Krishna Mareke, Mare Krishna Rakeke. If Krishna wants to protect someone, no one can kill that person. And if Krishna wants to destroy a person, no one can protect that person. So considering that, Bharat Maharaj should not have given up his devotional service for the sake of protecting a deer. But he did, fell down from his position. So this is the way Maya comes. In like a needle, out like a plow. In other words, it may start off very small, some minor thing, but gradually grows and grows and grows. So he may think, well, I'll make a little compromise with Maya. But Maya is like that. It's once you get a foot in the door, then it's very difficult to get you out. There's this kind of door-to-door salesman. You open the door, they're very aggressive. You open the door, they put their foot in it. Difficult to get rid of them. And they insist, you must buy my, as we're selling. In Bengali, there's a saying, Boshte dilei shuete chai. If you're on the train, it's very packed. You give someone a little space to sit down, and gradually they spread out and lie on the whole seat, and everyone else has no place to sit. Well, I guess you don't have this kind of thing in Lithuania. In the trains, usually the trains in India are very packed. There's no space. Most people are going standing. So someone might say, well, just move aside slightly and just give me a little space to sit. So they can just sit without putting their back on the seat, just at the edge of the seat. Gradually, when the person sitting next to them moves slightly to become a little more comfortable, they immediately move in a little bit on the other side also. So eventually he's sitting with his back against the seat and the other people are pushed forward. Then one of them may go up and go to the toilet, spread out, and there's no place for them to sit. So eventually he's lying down on the whole seat and everyone else who just gave him a little place to sit, they have no place to sit. It's just an example. If he actually did this in India, they'd probably throw him out of the train while it's moving at top speed. This is just an example. If he actually did this in India, they probably throw you out while the train is moving at top speed. That happens sometimes. India is the home of the highest spiritual culture, but it's also the home of some of the roughest people in the world. Some of you who have visited there may have noticed. So the example is there that if you give Maya a little chance, Maya will gradually increase. This is the danger of compromise. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur used to say, he who compromises is finished. So I'm saying, well, Krishna consciousness is very nice. But you know, you don't really have to follow everything. You can just do it little bit. Or you may think, well, I'm doing everything very nicely, so if I just change a little bit, it doesn't matter. You know, change the philosophy a little bit. You don't have to follow all the practices very strictly. Like, you're supposed to chant 16 rounds a day minimum. Well, you know, I chant 14 and then, you know, somehow I can't get the others. But, you know, 14, 16 doesn't make that much difference. Well, you know, all this rising early in the morning, it's not so important. I mean, do everything else. I remember one devotee said to me once, I asked him, well, why is it that you get up at 8 o'clock every morning? So he said to me, well, you know, most devotees who rise at 4 o'clock, they take some rest later in the day. Or they fall asleep while they're chanting japas. So I decided to sleep until 8 o'clock every morning. Then I don't take any rest in the day. I don't fall asleep. I chant really good rounds. So very intelligent, but it's bogus. It's a compromise because the injunction of Shastra is very clear that you should rise very early in the morning. Now, if you don't want to, you're not ready to, you can say that, and then it's understood that you're not really on the proper platform of Krishna consciousness. But if you try to justify it by some kind of philosophical or very intelligent idea, then it's a compromise. Or even if you don't try to justify it, if you just do it, well, it's also a compromise. That's one example. There may be so many. Yeah. Just like some people may say, well, we accept the Shastra says that Krishna is God, but we don't accept that, you know, things like the sun is, the moon is further away than the sun. How can we accept that? It doesn't make any sense. Oh, we may say, well, yeah, we accept this part of the Shastra, but not another part. Then what's the meaning of Shastra? Then what is the meaning of Shastra? You don't accept Shastra as being the gospel truth, then why read Shastra at all? It's not authoritative. If you don't accept the description of the cosmology as given in Shastra, you'll have a lot of problems. Because according to Shastra, the whole planetary systems are held up by a snake. And the earthly planetary system is held up by four elephants. When they move, there's an earthquake. If one of them moves, goes, not to speak, there's so many descriptions that how this universe was created by Brahma has four heads. Some Brahmas have millions of heads. And he was born on a lotus flower, which grows out of the navel of Mahavishnu. So these things are not likely to be accepted by scientists. Not likely as a euphemism. They're not going to be accepted. If we say not likely, that's a euphemism. Euphemism, you don't know that word? It sounds like Latin. Euphemism means an understatement or something which is stated in a polite way. Or if you look at the dictionary, you can see.
It's the same in Russian, euphemism.
Who gave the word? Where's Mrs. Sanatan Dharma? She's pretty good. My last sentence is that if you say not likely, it's a euphemism. All right, never mind. The scientists won't accept. If we want to adjust the philosophy of Krishna consciousness to be acceptable to materialists, it's not possible. You see, how are they going to accept, how is a materialistic person going to accept that the deities are just not, they're not some stone or brass doll? See, in the Hare Krishna temple, they put different dresses on these dolls. To the materialist, it's doll. Food. You won't eat that food until the doll, as they call, has eaten. So this is the materialistic vision. Materialist cannot understand. Because he's a materialist, ipso facto, he cannot understand the transcendental. That's the meaning of materialist, transcendentalist. means his vision cannot go beyond the material. So these things cannot be understood by material understanding, because material understanding is limited within the three modes of material nature. And spiritual life means that which is beyond the three modes of material nature. So that's why we don't preach these things among the materialists. They don't have the faith that is required to accept the transcendental. Materialism is foolishness. When we say the materialistic concept of life, that we only believe what we can see. There have been innumerable examples of supramundane experiences throughout the world, since time immemorial, by all kinds of people from all walks of life from all over the world. There is no lack of evidence of supramundane experiences. But the gross materialist, or the person who only accepts material, what he can see, says, well, I don't believe it because I never saw it. It's like the ostrich who puts his head in the sand. He thinks that by not seeing the reality of some animal coming to kill him, the wolf coming to kill him, he thinks that the wolf will cease to exist. Like the owl who very tightly closes his eyes at midday and says, there is no sun. Or maybe the bat, he can't see, even if he doesn't have to close his eyes. Try to explain to a person who's been blind from birth the beauty of the sunrise. Is there any way you can describe it so that he can understand? But because he can't conceive of it, it's inconceivable to him. Does that mean that such beauty does not exist? Because he has not experienced it, does that mean that no one has experienced? So a devotee should understand that when we're discussing Krishna, we're discussing that which is transcendental. And even when we discuss the descriptions in Bhagavatam of the material world, they may not tally with those which are conceived of by the modern scientists. But this is a description seen from the viewpoint of those with transcendental eyes. They can see things in a way that we don't see things. And there are many things which we may not be able to conceive of. Why should we think that everything should be within the power of vision of our eyes? So this is the basic faith that is required to enter into transcendental life. To accept that beyond that which we can see, touch, taste, smell, feel, and hear, there is reality on the supramundane level. It is not at all unreasonable to accept this. Why should we think that all of reality is within the scope of understanding of our very much limited senses? We can only see within a certain spectrum of light. We can only hear within a certain spectrum of sound. In this way, all our senses are limited. So in the same way, our powers of understanding are limited. Just like the blind man, he cannot conceive within his mind of what the sunrise looks like. Our power of internal visualization is limited to that which we have externally seen. Seen, touched, smelled, tasted, etc. So the transcendental process known as yoga is to awaken the transcendental power of our senses to perceive that which is beyond that which is normally conceived of by the senses. It is with faith in the transcendental process that one enters into it. And again, there is abundant evidence of all over the world since time immemorial of many, many people having such transcendental experiences. So we don't have to compromise our philosophy or our practices. If we do that, we will be finished. Basically, Krishna consciousness is developed by faith in Guru, faith in Shastra, and faith in Krishna. If we lose that, we lose everything. You don't have Krishna consciousness. So you should be very, very careful. Don't compromise, either philosophically or in our practices. If we compromise, Maya will enter. Maya entered in the form of a young deer in the life of Bharat Maharaj. Maya can enter in many, many different forms. But the result will be that our Krishna consciousness will be spoiled. Even though we may think that I'm doing nicely in Krishna consciousness, with our own interpretation of Krishna consciousness, the test of Krishna consciousness is if it is pleasing to Krishna, not if it fits with my own mental speculation. So be careful. Story of Bharat Maharaj, the main lesson that we are to gain from this is to be very careful in our activities of Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, we may have to suffer at least a temporary slowdown. Hare Krishna. Is there any question, please? Okay. First, listen, nice and enthusiastic to ask questions. Yeah, this example is given just like, even if you don't feel enthusiastic, just put your hands in the air and start to dance anyway. Well, that is not imitation of the exalted state of the Paramahamsa. That is imitation of sadhana. In the stage of sadhana, we should dance. Of course, topmost Paramahamsa will also dance. Sadhana means the practice by which we can come to the Paramahamsa level. So practically all of sadhana, in one sense, you could say it's like an imitation. We're told to chant Hare Krishna repeatedly. Actually, we don't have a taste for that, but we're engaged in that activity so that by doing it, we gradually get a taste for it. So to take up the activities of sadhana, such as dancing in kirtan, that's also one of the activities of sadhana. You'll find this mentioned among the 64 principles of devotional service. One should dance for the pleasure of the Lord. But we don't see that among the 64 principles it said that one should fall on the ground, one should shed tears from his eyes. That's not that. We will find in the Nectar of Devotion, Prabhupada writes that one should learn the technique of how to cry for Krishna. This is the secret of devotional life. If we think, well, okay, I'll put some chili powder in my eyes. You don't even have to put it in your eyes. You just put it in your nose. But that is artificial inducement. When it's said that one should learn to cry for Krishna, that means that by following the process of sadhana and praying to Krishna with such feeling, that one will actually feel for Krishna. That is not to be imitated. But chanting the holy name of the Lord, dancing in kirtan, all of these things, they should be done. Even if we don't have any feeling, they should be done, and feeling will begin to come. So this is the difference between imitation and following in the footsteps. Following in the footsteps means to follow the activities of sadhana. And imitation means to pose as if one is on a level more advanced than he actually is. Any other question? No, the spiritual master can do, spiritual master can't. If you make a promise and you don't follow, then what does spiritual master will do? How can he help? How can he help? Yes, how can he help? Spiritual master, God helps those who help themselves. If you make a promise, that means you should follow it. Once Prabhupada was asked that, what about your disciples who don't chant 16 rounds? Prabhupada said, they're not devotees, they're animals. He said, if you promise and you don't follow, that means you're an animal. Because a human being can promise, an animal cannot. That means we're on the animal platform. You can keep a promise. No one's forcing you, and you must take this vow. You're given plenty of time to consider. You take the vow, you should follow it. If you don't, then why should you think that I'm breaking the regulated principles, giving bad karma to my spiritual master to suffer? Shameless position. I had some experience that one disciple, he said, well, I reject you. Just a few months before, I didn't want to give him an issue. He's pushing and pushing and he said, well, I didn't invite you. I didn't say, come, please, you know, you must take initiation from me. You came to me. I didn't force myself on you. So now if you don't want to follow, I mean, that's, you made the vow, and now you're breaking it. That's your choice. I'm not going to stand next to you with a gun and force you to follow all these things. That would also be against the very regulated principles if I shot you. So, it's up to you. If you're not determined to follow throughout your life, then don't take the promise. That's all. And you don't take initiation. This is the standard within the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. That's what the whole class was about. Don't compromise. Think it's too difficult, don't do it. Now go and find some Sai Baba or something. You can do whatever you like. No, we're not saying you have to come here. If you don't think it's for you, fine, go and do whatever you like. Wine, have illicit sex, gamble, go to hell, do whatever you like. We're not forcing you to come here. But there are certain conditions for becoming Krishna conscious. This is the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. It's not the International Society for Krishna Compromise. If one compromise, then you make yourself a guru and preach whatever nonsense you like, or go to some guru who preaches whatever nonsense he likes. Do whatever you like. There may be no one coming. All right, that doesn't mean we're going to change the philosophy. Doesn't matter. You teach, you see, Tathagata. Do whatever you like. You're not satisfied? So you'll be satisfied. You go, there's so many shops that you can buy wine, you can do whatever you like. This movement is meant for Krishna consciousness. We have our principles. If you don't like it, fine. Go do whatever you like, wherever you like. If you want to be in this movement, there are certain principles which are not going to be changed. If you don't like it, there's no use to try and argue. We're not going to change. If you want to change, you can. But not within this organization. Then you start your own organization. Some people have done that. Three regulative principle. Okay, so do it. Fine. Any other question? Oh, there's one message you had. Beginning of Krishna consciousness, the training is how to become a Paramahamsa. We have to regularly hear so as to be in the right consciousness. We have, in recent times, there's been a lot of talk about nice relationships between devotees and all this kind of thing, which is good. But at the same time, we have to understand that nice relationships and love between devotees, it's not simply some kind of fuzzy feeling. Fuzzy feeling means some vague, ill-defined kind of sentimentalism. So the non-devotees, they also talk a lot about this, you know, loving and caring, material platform. Real love means to see devotee or anyone else, their part and parcel of Krishna. And especially we should care for those who have taken to devotional service, to try to help them to come up in devotional service. People who come to Krishna consciousness, they're very rare and valuable people. So certainly we want to see that they have sufficient material needs and also emotional needs, everything is taken care of. But at the same time, we should know that people, devotees included, can only ultimately be satisfied by becoming Krishna conscious. Sometimes devotees get into all this kind of thing, well, you know, you have this kind of syndrome because in your childhood, your father used to yell at you, kind of psychological analysis. So it may be that because your father yelled at you in your childhood, now you yell at others. It may be. But whatever the cause is, the cure is to become Krishna conscious. Your present psychological imbalance is not only because of what happened in this life, but because of what happened in many, many millions of lives. The root cause is our desire to lord it over matter because we're envious of Krishna. So ultimately, Krishna consciousness is the only solution to our problem. At the same time, it's not that we're just like marching in the army like this. Well, even in the army, you know, there's some camaraderie. So if we see a devotee is looking a little depressed, we might say, put our arm around and say, hey Prabhu, what's the problem? And try and help them. We don't want to become like some kind of sentimental, wishy-washy. Sorry. Your feelings and how you're feeling. Then we become very self-conscious if we're all the time thinking about my feelings and I have to have my feelings properly balanced. Krishna conscious means to consider how is Krishna feeling? How am I feeling? So if we simply try to act in a way that Krishna will feel satisfied with us, then we'll also feel satisfied. This is the secret. At the same time, we see great devotees by their behavior. They are very kind, but their kindness is not on the material platform. Actually, Prabhupada, with the devotees who are with many devotees, some devotees, he was very heavy, actually. His kindness manifested by hammering them. In that book I wrote, Glimpses of Traditional Indian Life, I wrote about one Madhva Sampradaya Brahmin, who with great affection told me about his father. He said, my father was so kind to me, he used to beat me so that I could learn Vishnu Sahasranam. And now every day throughout my life I'm chanting and I'm feeling so much ecstasy from chanting it. I'm very grateful to my father who forced me to learn this when I didn't want to. So that's not necessarily that every father should beat their child, even though in Vishnu Sahasranam. I'm just giving this as an example. It doesn't always mean just patting someone. Oh, he may manifest in different ways.